Today's episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. One of the best things about BetterHelp is that treatment is discreet and convenient. I know that especially in a small town, it might be difficult to find treatment, or it may be intimidating because small town gossip spreads like wildfire. You shouldn't feel judged for seeking help with your mental health. But if that's what's been holding you back, fear not, BetterHelp is here to save the day. BetterHelp is customized online therapy that offers video, phone, and even live chat sessions with your therapist, so you don't have to see anyone on camera unless you want to. It's much more affordable than in-person therapy, and you can start communicating with your therapist in under 48 hours. And thanks to the great people at BetterHelp, I have a special offer for Obscure History listeners. You can get 10% off your first month of professional therapy at betterhelp.com/obscure. That's betterhelp.com/obscure. Thanks again to BetterHelp for sponsoring this episode. To all the mothers of the world, I wish you a happy late Mother's Day. We all owe so much to our mothers, and it's a wonderful sentiment to acknowledge the many sacrifices a mother makes for her children. But do we really know where Mother's Day comes from? Have you ever wondered? Buckle up, because the history of the holiday known for floral arrangements and pastel greeting cards has its origins in war, death, legal battles, and sanatoriums. My name is Josh, and this is Obscure History. There are few events in American history as monumental as the Civil War. It is a reminder of the seismic growth of our nation, growing pains that pulled at the seams of our country, ripping and tearing family trees apart. Brothers against brothers, kinfolk against kinfolk. It should be recognized as a truly unprecedented time, even as we look back from our own unprecedented time. And the trauma of the war extends beyond the political and historical implications. The sheer brutality of the conditions the soldiers faced and the new and devastating weaponry they endured is shocking even still. But don't take my word for it. The voices from the past inform us in greater detail than I ever could. According to Lieutenant Frederick Hitchcock, a member of the 132nd Pennsylvania Volunteers, who witnessed the bloodiest day of battle in the entire war, "We moved, as I thought, rather leisurely for upwards of 2 miles, crossing Antietam Creek, which our men waded nearly waist-deep, emerging, of course, soaked through, our first experience of this kind. It was a hot morning, and therefore the only ill effect of this waiting was the discomfort to the men of marching with soaked feet. It was now quite evident that a great battle was in progress, a deafening pandemonium of cannonading and shrieking and bursting shells filled the air beyond us, towards which we were marching. An occasional shell whizzed by or over, reminding us that we were rapidly approaching the debatable ground. Soon we began to hear a most ominous sound which we had never before heard, except in the far distance at South Mountain, namely, the rattle of musketry. It had none of the deafening bluster of the cannonading so terrifying to new troops, but to those who had once experienced its effects, it was infinitely more to be dreaded. These volleys of musketry were approaching, sounded in the distance like the rapid pouring of a shot upon a tin pan, or the tearing of heavy canvas with slight pauses interspersed with single shots or desultory shooting. All this presaged fearful work in store for us, with what results to each personally in the future, measured probably by moments, would reveal. How does one feel under such conditions? To tell the truth, I realized the situation most keenly and felt very uncomfortable. Lest there might be some undue manifestation of this feeling on my conduct, I said to myself, This is the duty I undertook to perform for my country, and now I'll do it and leave the results with God. My greater fear was not that I might be killed, but that I might be grievously wounded and left a victim suffering on the field. The nervous strain was plainly visible upon all of us. All moved doggedly forward in obedience to orders, in absolute silence so far as talking was concerned. The compressed lip and set teeth showed that nerve and resolution had been summoned to the discharge of duty. A few temporarily fell out, unable to endure the nervous strain. The war imprinted lasting trauma on every American, in some way, and that legacy of trauma is still tangible today. But out of this sorrow and bloodshed, there came gleaming rays of hope. Most obviously, the results of the Civil War solidified that once and for all, our nation would be united, for better or worse, in sickness and in health. Second, the victory of the Union paved the way for every American to have their voice heard, and to strive for the American dream of freedom, prosperity, and happiness, though it would take more time and effort to see that vision of America come to fruition. Less obviously, it gave our nation a chance to heal deep divisions between its people. Obviously, not every division was healed, but after the dust had settled and the blood cleared from the pastures of our Atlantic coast, small groups of hopeful Americans set about the difficult work of reuniting a once divided land. Surprisingly, one of those efforts would have unexpected and far-reaching ramifications. Anne Marie Reeves Jarvis was born in Culpeper, Virginia on September 30th, 1832. As a woman in the early 19th century, she understood all too well the difficulties of her era. On top of witnessing the Civil War in its bloodiest and most disputed state, she also felt the pain of losing children due to poor health care and unsanitary conditions. It is estimated that Anne Jarvis gave birth to as many as 13 children, though only 4 would survive into adulthood. As a woman of action and dynamic leadership, this personal loss prompted her to start various clubs throughout West Virginia, where she would eventually live. In these clubs, she fought to improve the conditions of her fellow women and their children. According to the West Virginia State Archives, Jarvis organized a series of Mother's Day work clubs in Webster, Grafton, Fetterman, Pruntytown, and Philippi to improve health and sanitary conditions. Among other services, the clubs raised money for medicine, hired women to work for families in which the mothers suffered from tuberculosis, and inspected bottled milk and food. In 1860, local doctors supported the formations of clubs in other towns. The Baltimore and Ohio Railroad made Taylor County a strategic site during the Civil War. Anne Jarvis urged the Mother's Day work clubs to declare their neutrality and provide relief to both Union and Confederate soldiers. The clubs treated the wounded and regularly fed and clothed soldiers stationed in the area. Jarvis also managed to preserve an element of peace in a community being torn apart by political differences. During the war, she worked tirelessly, despite the personal tragedy of losing her children. Near the end of the war, the Jarvis family moved to the larger town of Grafton. Tensions increased as both Union and Confederate soldiers returned at war's end. In the summer of 1865, Anne Jarvis organized a Mother's Friendship Day at the courthouse in Pruntytown to bring together soldiers and neighbors of all political beliefs. The event was a great success, despite the fear of many that it would erupt in violence. Mother's Friendship Day was an annual event for several years. In a place and time full of intense turmoil, Anne Jarvis was a beacon of light, a peacekeeper. She was so well respected that she was involved in the oversight of the construction of the Andrews Methodist Church in Grafton. This, in and of itself, is an impressive legacy. She saw a need in her corner of the world and devoted her life to meeting it. We should all strive for the same. And when she died in 1905, her daughter Anna held a modest service in her honor at Andrews Methodist Church. Little did she know, but this would be just the beginning of her mother's legacy, and the beginning of her own downfall. But before we get to the drama, we do need to pay the bills. If you want ad-free episodes with bonus content, simply hit the subscribe button on Apple Podcasts, and your wish will be granted. For everyone else, check out the free Discord server, link in the show notes, to keep up to date with the show and have fun history discussions with a group of like-minded nerds. It is completely free, and I would love to see you there. Hang tight for about 90 seconds, and we'll be right back. Anna Jarvis, Anne Jarvis's daughter, was encouraged by her mother to attend college at Mary Baldwin University. She proved to be a successful student and ambitious businesswoman. After her uncle, Dr. James Edmund Reeves, persuaded her to move to Chattanooga, Tennessee, Jarvis worked there as a bank teller for a year. The following year, Jarvis again moved, this time to live with her brother in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, in spite of her mother's urging to return to Grafton. Jarvis was successful in Pennsylvania, taking a position at Fidelity Mutual Life Insurance Company, where she became the agency's first female literary and advertising editor. Despite keeping a very busy schedule in her various business endeavors, she maintained very close correspondence with her mother. When Anne's health began to decline, she moved to Philadelphia, where Anna took care of her until her death. After her death, Anna arranged the unexpectedly consequential memorial at Andrews Methodist Church, and after the memorial, she became the torchbearer of her mother's legacy. On May 10, 1908, 3 years after her mother's death, Jarvis held a memorial ceremony to honor her mother and all mothers at Andrews Methodist Episcopal Church, which is marked today as the International Mother's Day Shrine. Anne didn't attend the service, but she did send words of encouragement and approval, along with 500 white carnations. She also delivered a rousing speech near her home in Philadelphia, extolling the value of motherhood. The celebration of motherhood began catching on, and it's easy to see why. Everyone feels sentimental about their mom, or at least the vast majority of people do, so the holiday was relevant to almost everyone. It was also easily commodifiable, as Jarvis's white carnations became an integral part of Mother's Day festivities countrywide. And as such, the celebration became commercialized and profitable. In fact, by the 1920s, in addition to the holiday becoming federally recognized, the floral industry continued increasing prices of white carnations, and then introduced red carnations to meet the demand for the flower. Anna Jarvis's original symbols began to become reappropriated, such as the red carnation representing living mothers and the white carnation honoring deceased ones. To combat the commercialization of the holiday she held so close to her heart, Jarvis attempted to create a new piece of Mother's Day tradition by creating a badge with a Mother's Day emblem, something that would be more personal and more sentimental. But those efforts were quickly adopted by printing companies, where mass-market Mother's Day cards were immediately adopted as an essential part of the celebration. Anne Jarvis was very publicly opposed to this commercialization of her Mother's Day. As she recalled in a biting criticism, "A printed card means nothing except that you are too lazy to write the woman who has done more for you than anyone in the world. And candy, you take a box to mother, then eat most of it yourself. A pretty sentiment." The corruption of Mother's Day affected Jarvis so much that she went on the offensive. She began petitioning and taking offensive legal action wherever she could think to do so. However, the various legal battles left her in debt, and she, despite founding a million-dollar holiday, was not profiting from her own creation. She didn't stop, though, continuing to fight for her beliefs well into her 70s. Jarvis never married, and in her later years moved in with her sister. Her final attempt to defend her mother's honor came when she tried to file an official petition to remove the holiday from federal recognition. Shortly afterward, she was detained in Marshall Square Sanatorium in Westchester, Pennsylvania, where she would eventually die. But maybe you've been paying close attention to this story. Maybe you're wondering how a nearly 80-year-old woman who was completely financially destitute could pay for boarding at the sanatorium. She didn't pay for it. And neither did her sister. The answer may shock you, but in a spot for NPR, Olive Ricketts, director of the Anna Jarvis Museum, noted that, by 1943, she had become so distraught over the fact that she couldn't seem to stop any of the commercialization, so she decided to get a petition together to rescind Mother's Day. But they placed her in the Marshall Square Sanatorium instead. And they put her there. And you wonder who paid the bill? Card and florist people paid the bill to keep her there. The woman who founded Mother's Day to honor the legacy of her incredible mother died childless, penniless, and alone in a sanatorium, all because of her dedication to the honor of her mother. Her outspoken political beliefs kept potential suitors away, her various legal battles leached her savings until only a bare skeleton remained, and the threat that she posed to various corporate interests locked her up and threw away the key. So next year, when May rolls around on the calendar, remember that that one special day we dedicate to mothers has a checkered past marred with bloodshed, betrayal, and some all too recognizable American greed. Hey everybody, thank you so much for listening. I sincerely appreciate all of you. I'm sorry that the episode is late. I went out of town to visit my mother, and when I got back, I was not feeling very well, and so I'm a little bit slow to get this one out. It's also a bit short. I apologize for that also, sort of, kind of. Sometimes a story is better left a little bit short, because if I blather on too much, I might lose the plot, and you probably wouldn't want that anyways. I also apologize to subscribers, as I was feeling not very well. I did not get bonus content out for this episode. I apologize. Next week, I'll be super prepared, and I'll have something very fun for you guys. I appreciate you all. Check out my friends, Greg at Indie Drop-In Network and Ariel at Earbuds Podcast Collective. They are two of the best people in the industry, and I appreciate them a ton. You should check out their products. They will help you find your next second favorite show. Until next week, thank you so much. I appreciate you all.